Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
Guy, you've talked about how you are haunted by lost films. Going back to the early silent film era, is it fair to say that this is an obsession for you?
Yeah, I've always been a person of obsessions. What have I been obsessed with when I was, you know, six? Monster models. when I was an adolescent, baseball stats, memorized books of baseball stats, frightened people. They were worried about me.
I memorized baseball stats too, so.
Yeah, I memorized a whole book once. I remember trying to impress these really pretty, the Patton twins, the Betty and Veronica of the beach. And they thought I was doing a trick, No, I was just simply memorizing. Yeah. It was really creepy.
So what is it about these old films?
Well, it became an obsession when, as an undergrad, I started watching movies again. But as a kind of a grown-up or an aspiring grown-up, and I became an Alfred Hitchcock fan. I became an F.W. Murnau fan. And so in those pre-internet days, I would just go to the library and look up all their films and try to see them either on 16mm or VCR. But I would discover that not all of them were available. Not unlike library books, where you can through interlibrary loan and get. But some of these movies were lost. What does that mean? And then I'd read up about it and discover that because film is such a young art form, it wasn't even considered an art form. It was a product at first, and so studios would clear out a whole year's worth of a shelf of product. Toss it in the ocean or burn it at a staff bonfire.
So it just wasn't worth anything, or they didn't think it was.
They didn't think it was anything. And then, films were shipped to New Zealand, and then because it would cost too much to ship them back, theater managers down under were ordered to destroy the prints, that sort of thing. So, and then some of them just got misplaced for other reasons, or just crumbled to dust because they didn't get stored. And so a lot of masterpieces and a lot of indifferent and even poor stuff has been lost. And
you think masterpieces too?
Some for sure, because film scholars would kill to watch Hitchcock's first film, The Mountain Eagle. F.W. Murnau lost films in the prime of his career, and films made, and Joseph von Sternberg lost films after he'd already made masterpieces and before he made more masterpieces. So
you're talking, some of the greats of early cinema. You're saying some of their films just disappeared.
And they were lost during, I have an elderly mother, 97, but lost many, 80% of the silent films made in Hollywood were lost during my mother's lifetime, so this is all recent. Recent stuff, and every now and then something turns up, usually in New Zealand where none of those guys destroyed the prints, thank God. But they just pop up in the oddest places. I could go on forever describing these eccentric. The lost Carl Theodore Dreyer, The Passion of Joan of Arc, showed up in 1980 in a janitor's closet in a mental hospital in Oslo.
Considered one of the great films of all time.
Yeah. And so they do turn up, but mostly now that I'm embarked on a project that needs lost films, I'm making my own adaptations of lost films to try to do something with the haunting that's keeping me in a fever dream constantly.
Now, when you say making your own adaptations, what, shooting from the script that might exist? I mean, actually trying to reshoot the film that maybe was made, 80, 100 years ago?
Yeah, at first, I told myself, I really want to see, Todd Browning and Lon Chaney's London After Midnight, but it's not showing up, so it looks like I'll have to make it myself. And that sounds really arrogant, but it wasn't out of arrogance. I started to think about how, say, this Salome as an ancient text was adapted by so many different artists at the end of the 19th century. Gustave Moreau made his Salome paintings, Franz Stuck, there's this Salome the opera, the Aubrey Beardsley drawings, the Oscar Wilde play. And I just thought, why not just treat these for the new medium, ancient lost texts as sacred texts, and just do my own version of them. But I noticed just a simple coincidence that movie screenings in France are called séances led me to a more paranormal solution. And I don't believe in any of that stuff. But séance just means a seating. And in France, it means a seating in the dark to watch a movie. And here it means a paranormal, a seating in the dark to see a spirit. But there's really, since photographs of people are ghosts in that there's a temporal separation from the photograph and its subject, the instant the shutters clicked, and that the what's left in the emulsions is a ghost, something that just sort of has a life of its own long after the original subject is dead and gone.
Well, and it's worth pointing out that a lot of your films have had ghosts in them. I mean, going back to, what, one of your first films, The Dead Father?
Yeah, and I don't believe in ghosts, but when I'm holding a camera, I do. It's just a convenient belief to have when you're holding a camera. I'm not sure Shakespeare believed in ghosts, but Hamlet's father's ghost comes in pretty handy, you know, as a narrative device to stand in for an undying memory, you know.
So wait, is that what ghosts are? Memories?
I think so. For me, just to be literal-minded and just offer a solution for me, but I just, I use memories and ghosts as interchangeable terms. You know, Faulkner said we all live in the past and the present simultaneously, and we do. So we're just navigating our way through the world in a sea of ghosts. The ghost of the toaster my dad used to use in the mornings in the 70s. I can still hear it clicking the warm bread up in my memories now and then. So
memory is the past is very present for you?
It is. The past ain't even the past. That's a Faulkner's thing. But that's the end of my bookish explanations about these things. Yeah, I've always been very in touch with my past. Whenever something happens in the present, I quickly cross-reference it with similar things that have happened in the past to other people, to myself, to my relatives during my prehistory. I try to understand what a similar experience was for them before I was born. And
during your prehistory, that's such an interesting word.
Well, I was born as the youngest of four kids, and I think my parents are pretty spent, and they just put me, they brought me and the new TV home at the same time and just put us on the floor together. And I think they put me facing in the wrong direction. I was just looking backward all the time. And we had photo albums, black and white photo albums that just showed my young, still completely hirsute dad and my cheery mom and my three siblings all packed into a station wagon and coming down to Wisconsin, coming down to Minnesota, driving to California, going to the Grand Canyon, whereas I just sort of sat there just feeling my bones dissolve like sugar cubes in a hot cup of coffee. And it just struck me that my family was happier before I came along. and there was a certain romanticization. But since all the photos were in black and white, I had trouble actually believing that was them somehow.
Well, I mean, it's so interesting hearing you say that because a lot of your films have been in black and white. I mean, you're very, it would seem, self-consciously evoking the past in movies that you make now.
There's something, you know, we can all see and recognize human figures, celebrity, you know, in black and white. But that's, unless you're colorblind, you're getting with a black and white movie, you're getting less than what you can see with the, so it's a veil of mystery brought down, a monochromatic veil. You're seeing it in two dimensions. Maybe the audio is recorded poorly, or dialogue is delivered in a stylized, rapid-fire fashion. And you begin to wonder if those people really are real, or that anyone, you know, if these things, even though they look like humans, you just wonder how accurately they are. So representing, this just creates an interesting tension to me that always reminds me of a two-cylinder lawnmower engine that just runs very simply and forever, needs very little maintenance. Just this constant tension I have when I'm watching film. And to me, film is the great mythologizer, you know. No disrespect to Homer, I love reading Homer, but now I feel like, you know, since the 20th century, we can consider ourselves consecrated as myths of one form, in one form or another, if we've been committed to film.
Well, and of course, film is the great creator of illusions.
Yes,
I mean, going back to ghosts, and it strikes me that there's sort of two ways you can think about it. And maybe this is sort of the vehicle to greater truth in some way, or you're a conjurer, you know, you're
exactly,
a charlatan in a way because, you're creating artifice.
I use that word all the time, you know, because I don't believe in paranormal seances. And the medium there is a charlatan, a mountebank, and so is the director of a movie. Even a documentary filmmaker with the best intentions in the world is presenting a viewpoint, an agenda or whatever, and is a species of charlatan, and they have to manipulate things.
And I suppose one way to think about what you're doing, I mean, you're kind of a spirit medium, going back to these lost films. I mean, you're bringing back the spirits of these dead filmmakers.
Yeah, so what I do is I gather a bunch of actors together in a public space. I've shot for 3 weeks at the Centre Pompidou in Paris. I shot for 3 weeks at the Centre Fee in Montreal. And there's some other public museum séances planned, séance de spiritisme in France.
And when you say séances, what are you talking about? What do you
do? Well, I get a bunch of actors together in Paris. It was great. I had Charlotte Rampling and Mathieu Amalric and Geraldine Chaplin and some people I've long admired. And Udo Kier. And I put them into trances. Actors are very easy to put into trances. Sometimes you just brush up against them on the way to the coffee machine and they go into a trance. But I gathered them around the table. They held hands, just like in hokey seances in movies. We lowered the lights and they went into a trance. And then I invited the sad spirit of a lost film to enter into us, and to possess us and to compel us to act out its long forgotten plots. And then as spirit photographer, I just shot them acting out these long forgotten plots and have edited them together into movies. It was pretty wild. So I plan to shoot too many of these things to count and load them up into a website and have the spirits interrupt each other in a number of programmed to be random ways, the way spirits interrupt each other in the kind of seances we're familiar with on movies.
This sounds like a surrealist project. And you're a big fan of the surrealist, going back to Bleuel and those people,
right? It is surrealist, but I'm counting on some of the collisions among the stories to form really intriguing and delightful non sequiturs. And I can count on some of them being dull. And but you can always abort the viewing experience if it's dull. The interesting thing to me is that these lost movies come together and combine in many combinations and permutations, interrupting each other and forming, I hope, now and then, really delightful experiences, ones that will enchant people who visit the site and enjoy a seance. And then that combination is lost forever. It's destroyed by the program. So you both see a narrative come together and then lose it instantly. So I just felt it was important that loss be part of the viewing experience.
Now, when you use the word hauntings, and that figures prominently in your film history, is that just metaphor or is it more than that?
No, I felt kind of haunted, and I've had a sort of a haunted childhood. My mom is just one of those people. I dropped out of grade 8 and doesn't put much stock in book learning or anything like that. But when she talks about the family history, it just comes out mythically. And everything feels like she's cribbing from the Old Testament or an ancient manuscript or something, or at least from the Brothers Grimm or Hans Christian Andersen or something. And her way of making sense of the world or misremembering it is always in mythic or folkloric ways. And so when she talks about her past, my prehistory, it really does inform her current behavior and our family's way of making sense of each other, which isn't the best, probably. I get haunted by this stuff.
What would be an example of a piece of your personal history that is kind of mythic in nature?
Well, it's not only mythic, but it's true. It literally happens. My father had a glass eye. I could see it. It's true. And apparently, my mom just told me when I was about two or three. You know, your father lost his eye when on his first birthday, his mother clutched him to her bosom and she had an unpinned brooch and it poked his eye out.
Oh my
and,
God.
and ever since then, she's been poking her own eyes out in all photographs of herself and that sort of thing. So it's, you know, all of a sudden we're getting into Oedipus light or something like that. And my mom hasn't read, you know, she hasn't read Greek tragedians, you know. She just pulls these things out of the Ur myth bog back home on the farm. Her father, I don't know what was going on there on the farm, but something heavy. When he died on the farm, this kind of brutally isolated Icelandic farm.
This is what, near Winnipeg?
Yeah, it's about 40 minutes of just grim driving onto ever narrowing roads. Finally, you're just clomping over heaps of manure and things like that into a bog. And then my grandfather, who was 100 years older than I am, so I never met him, died during flood season. My mom had to ride a horse out to the farm, which, you know, was submerged in swamp water up to its chest. And when she finally got there, she just watched her father expire, his last breath. And then she and her mother stripped him naked and sewed a brand new funeral suit of clothing onto him while her siblings built the coffin and dug a grave, which was full of flood water. And so they had to sink this coffin by all six children standing on the coffin
and making sure
he went down and stayed down while they all gathered onto themselves slop and sort of slowly stood up and made sure he stayed down and made sure he sort of, like, the bubbles came out of the coffin and they kept him down. And he's been down there ever since.
And this is the kind of stuff that I'm not even sure novelists could dream up.
Yeah, no, and it all really happened. And but when my mom tells the story, it's just so matter of fact. There's no embellishment or anything. She doesn't need a lute or anything to tell it. She just tells it matter of factly. No, so I started to think of my prehistory and these kind of, and I didn't read much as a kid, but they just seem like Sunday school stories to me. They had the same qualities.
Wow. Now, as I was reading about your background, I'd read that your father, I guess, died when you were young.
And, yeah, 21. I was 21.
And then you had a lot of dreams about him, where he would appear after
I
he
did.
Died.
It was just Hamlet's father's ghost. I think this must happen to a lot of people. He meant a lot to me, but I feared his death. He had a bad heart condition. Feared his death years before it came. And when it finally did come, I expected to be hit with a wrecking ball that would, from which I'd never recover. But I was surprised. I wasn't grieving at all. But I suppose I spread my grieving out over in some bizarre dream installment plan. And so every night for many years, for a few decades even, in dreams that became very pleasant, he would come home. It turns out he hadn't died. I'd always forget that there was a funeral and that he hadn't died. Instead, he just found a better, more interesting family to live with. And he was just coming back to get his glass eye or his Gillette Track 2 razor or something like that. And I had about a minute, 90 seconds maybe, to convince him to give our family another chance. And he never did. He always left again. And but during that time, I remembered his voice in ways I couldn't while I was awake.
Mm. So you actually could hear his voice.
Oh, yeah, really. Wow. Clearly. Mm. And some of the dreams over the decades, they started to evolve to the point where I'd have discussions. I remember having a long discussion about Buster Keaton with him. Now, he was not interested in film, but by the time, you know, and I think my memory was actually uncovering things about him that I hadn't noticed while he was alive. The Buster Keaton thing was a projection. I'm sure he wouldn't have cared. But I did start to understand him better, and then just getting older. And now I'm like a year younger than he was when he died. I hope I can beat him somehow. But no, I think I understand him now. But I've made a couple of movies about these dreams. As a matter of fact, those dreams made me want to make movies because I thought these feelings are so bittersweet. They're things that literature should be. They should pull you in two different directions at once.
And your movies have a very dreamlike quality.
Yeah, I thought I'll never be a slick filmmaker. I'll never be technically proficient. I can't even take a Christmas snapshot or anything. But the early primitive film work of Buñuel and Dalí gave me hope. Those films aren't technically sharp, but they're technically perfect. You know, they're primitive in ways that are just right for the subject matter. There's bad continuity. They use their friends as actors in most cases. There's some gifted actors in there, but mostly it's just pals and just some really interesting ideas. And I thought my only hope was to come up with some ideas that meant a lot to me, that were really true to me, and then just primitively collage them together and hope that someone would like them. So they do feel like dreams. They're kind of surrealist, I guess. I've always been a bit sheepish about being I'm a species of surrealist at a time when surrealism's been, you know, assimilated and it's working really at its best in Madison Avenue, you know. It's like, you know, you don't want a commercial that isn't slightly surreal. Come on.
So is the idea that the greater truth, the most important truth, is underneath the surface, perhaps in our unconscious, and that's what art can do in some ways, is to sort of get at that?
Yeah, I'm certainly not a psychologist, nor a Jungian, or any, you know, I don't know, you know, I'm a dilettante in almost every front, but I just know that that we repress a lot of feelings during the day, and and then we're allowed to disinhibit them during our dreams. They distort themselves. They don't come up as unvarnished truth, but there's stuff to be figured out about what might be going on. And, you know, you're allowed to do a lot more stuff in your dreams, but you're more tormented in your dreams too. And it's just pretty interesting what comes out of the what comes out of the box when you fall asleep. And so I've, every now and then something comes out that makes sense to me as a scene that just seems to be well written. And my daughter, who is really hooked into her prehistory, perhaps because I talked about mine a lot, has lent me some of her dreams. I ended my movie, My Winnipeg, with a dream my daughter had about my dead brother lying in a gutter with my mother. And wow. It was a very strange and moving dream she couldn't quite figure out, but she told it to me, and I went, that's the ending I need for my movie, you know. And so I felt, it felt great to collaborate with my dreaming daughter as a dreaming father, making movies together.
Hmm. How do you evoke a dream on film? What are the techniques of the filmmaker to do that?
I don't know. It's just, you know, you can't really, you're always in film since you're, it's not life, and we don't want film to be life. We want it to be a take on life. But dreams have a lot of ellipses. They have leaps. We're not the kind we're not used to making when we're awake. I think performances in dreams are more uninhibited, more melodramatic. And when the truth is uninhibited, I that suggests that it's more true. The truth is more apparent. When truth is exaggerated, a lot of people describe melodrama as being truth exaggerated. Well, that would, an exaggerated truth would be less true, but an uninhibited truth would be more useful to people seeking the truth. So I like to think of dreams with all their disinhibition as being something that's a little bit closer to the truth. So I try to put, things I've noticed about myself, truths that are contradictory and embarrassing, perhaps. I've tried to put them right into the movies and to be uninhibited about expressing them, and elliptical as well. Big holes, big leaps for the viewers to make. And then I have other concerns too. I'm not just a surrealist. I'm a melodramatist and an ancient Greek, and a dilettante. I'm a serious dilettante, I just work kind of intuitively. And since presenting movies with live elements, which I started to do in the, you know, around 2006.
So there's this combination of movie plus performance art.
Yeah, and I've suddenly, instead of just being a filmmaker, which a term which always implies that you're making something for yourself, and if someone likes it, that's fine, you know, like, you know, more like an author. But I feel more like a showman. When you're sitting there nervous, hoping the orchestra doesn't screw up, or hoping the projections or the castrato remembers his lines, and I broke a molar when Lou Reed was narrating my movie Brand Upon the Brain and fell asleep. No one could wake him up, and I shattered a molar, and I realized, you know, I'm in show business now, you know.
You know, as I think about your project of bringing back these lost films, these hundreds and hundreds of lost films where, you know, maybe the film stock disappeared. Maybe they weren't even made, but, you know, they were just great ideas.
Doesn't even matter.
It almost strikes me that, I mean, you could imagine this as an alternative universe. I mean, suppose all these films had been made. I mean, there'd be this whole different history of the cinema. And to some degree,
I know,
it seems like you're playing with that idea.
Yeah, it's one big butterfly effect. A lot of the movies I'm making now, since I expanded my definition of what's lost to films that weren't made, but could have been made. It started innocently enough with Jean Vigo, the great French filmmaker who died at age 29 in 1934. I have some of his unrealized projects, and I know his daughter, who was 3 when he died, and she's in her 80s now. And she gave me permission to shoot some of these. And so I did. And my rationalization was, well, the movies aren't lost, but we lost Vigo so young. We lost so much film. Let's go to that. And then I started thinking more about other, you know, people who'd been marginalized by our unfortunate history, African-American filmmakers. There's one, Oscar Michaud, who sold Bibles door to door, worked as a Pullman porter, and somehow got really low budget films. He's unfairly called the Ed Wood of the Black Ed Wood.
Ed Wood being the master of the B movie.
Yeah, that's right. It's a comparison that's unfair to both artists. I love them both. But he faced so many obstacles, and so many of his movies are lost because, there's Spencer Williams. There were so many other African-American filmmakers, but there would have been more had there not been segregation in the industry. And same with Native Americans. James Young Deere was the first Native American to make a film. And some people think he was African-American pretending to be Native American so he could make get some films made. He finally moved to London and disappeared. But, of course, women in certain countries were discouraged from making films, and so their films disappeared, and so did they. There were some anti-arranged marriage films made in Egypt that are long gone. Strangely, in the early decades of cinema, a lot of women made films, pro-eugenics films. Eugenics was a very progressive fad for a while. You know, the compulsory sterilization of dumb people.
That was a progressive movement.
A lot of progressive people got into it. It sounds ridiculous now. And just before making the controversial Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith, you know, film where the Ku Klux Klan played heroes, he made a pro-eugenics movie, which is lost, The Escape. He made an apology for Birth of a Nation called The Greatest Thing in Life, in which a racist white man kisses a dying African-American soldier on the lips just as his last breath exhales, and he is seized with brotherly love and looks for other dying African-American soldiers to kiss. It becomes a mania for him. That film is lost. There's all sorts of strange political films out of America that are lost. But I started to think of like that life unlived that we all have. You know, we live two lives. The one we're living now facing each other, and then the ones we wish we were living. Film has that too. It has its two histories, the one that it had and the one it perhaps could have had. And that haunts me.
Wow. Do you have a dream film? I mean, if money were no object, given all that we've been talking about, ghosts, hauntings, the history of lost cinema, is there the Guy Madden film waiting to be made?
Oh, geez, I should have an answer ready for that. But I know when you say money is no object, I'd still like to, I'm a kind of a Buñuelian that way. I think he spent his entire career making films. All of them had, I read this in 1983, he said the about $100,000 budget. So it'd be the equivalent of maybe making a, you know, $700,000 film now or something like that. I think that's about the right amount. It would be great to have that every time out. Sometimes I have to make my movies for $20,000.
And is there a sort of a subject out there that you're dying to do still?
Lately, because I've been involved in such a mind-breakingly huge Synecdoche, New York sprawling thing that seems like it'll never end, I've wanted to make a 70-minute long, hard-boiled, simple simple two-hander or three-hander, like Edgar Ulmer's Detour, a really, you know, savage noir portrait of a, I guess it's a sour marriage, or Wicked Woman, or something like, there's a Charlie McGraw crime picture called The Threat, which just has a kind of a nice low-budget muscularity to it. I'd like to have that, but with something frou-frou about it, because I'm never happy until I've sprinkled some spangles on things. So maybe a real alpha male sweaty stare down with lots of spangles somehow that feels like its story was born before Moses somehow. So I guess some sort of heist picture. I don't know.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you.